Good evening.
Good evening.
Recently at Tassajara, I discovered, while rummaging through the library, this old copy of an English translation of the Soto School Constitution. Only a couple people had checked it out in the last decades. It was a hand-typed thing. I don't know who did it, unpublished. And I picked it up, just because various people have got me thinking about organization of Zen centers and things like that. So I forgot to mention to the board at the meeting last night that if you'd like a I could email you a copy if you want of the Soto Shu Constitution. And, it's like the bylaws and it's lots of legal language and it's very detailed and it's only the outline, I think, too. Then talks about, some of the same types of stuff. It talks about the board of some kind of board anyway, and how that gets set up and the relationship to the Kancho, that's like the head of the Pope of Soto Zen and things like that. And how the whole structure of temples and lay supporters and things like that. The part that was most interesting to me was the very beginning. It defines, it says, the name of this organization shall be called the Soto Shu. Have people not heard of the Soto Shu? Some people. That's this school of Zen. Shu means like school or sect or branch of some spiritual organization. And Soto comes from the two teachers or founders, So Zan and To Zan in 9th century China. So the Soto school, this particular lineage of Zen, going back to Japan, China, and India to Shakyamuni Buddha, which is what the Constitution says. It's in English, but it's a Japanese, it's a Japanese constitution. Someone translated into English. I think it's pretty old because it's done like a manual typewriter. But I typed it into the computer because I thought it was, because we don't have a Xerox machine, so that's where I can email it now. Some of the really like boring parts I skipped typing in. But the beginning, it was, I thought, kind of moving because it sets up the, as probably all these kinds of documents, it's sort of like a mission statement, right? At the beginning, it says, after the name of this institution shall be called the Soto School, it says, the section's called, like, doctrine. The basic doctrine. And I think a lot of these schools, maybe constitutions, I heard a story that maybe around like the Meiji Reformation time, like 1800s, maybe before then actually in Japan, the government wanted to just start really defining different schools and kind of like getting really like specific about like, if the government was going to help support these kind of organizations, like what are the tenets of your school compared to this other school? Let's not be wishy-washy about this. So there was some point anyway in Japanese history where these schools sort of took upon themselves the task to define themselves. And so the second article or something in this constitution is the basic doctrine of the Soto school. Is something like the Buddhas and ancestors, single transmission, or simple transmission, straightforward transmission of the teachings of just sitting, shikantaza, and this very mind is Buddha, sokushin zebutsu, which is also a title of a chapter in the Shobogenzo of Dogen. These are all teachings of Dogen Zenji, the Japanese founder of the Soto school, kind of what they sort of pulled out of his teachings and called the basic fundamental things. So I thought that was interesting, that the basic I think at this point they call it the tenets, the fundamental tenets are just wholeheartedly sitting, and this very mind is Buddha, which I would propose are the same thing said in two different ways. And it's a practice. It's the Buddhas and ancestors transmit the teaching of just wholeheartedly sitting, and they transmit the teaching of this very mind is Buddha. And then maybe the next item up near the top is I think the doctrine. One they call it the tenets, and one they call it doctrine. I don't know if these in Japanese what the difference is, but maybe they had to define these different categories. So I think it's the doctrine that they say is what is taught. The two other teachings that are taught, and these are Zen and precepts are one suchness, or the teaching of the one suchness of Zen and precepts, or Zen and, you know, ethical conduct or virtue. And the non-duality of practice and realization. So those two items. And then it starts getting into, you know, all the bureaucratic details of the school. But I thought this one, it just lays these four basic teachings. And again, I think we could say these two are saying the same thing, and they're also saying the same thing as just sitting and this mind is Buddha. So I would say there are four different aspects of summarizing the whole style of this particular school of Zen. And I thought it was very moving to me to just read that, even in a this kind of like technical kind of document, or you know, institutional kind of document. I thought, like, oh yeah, I'll be a member of that school when I heard that. And that's something that I'd like to give my life to, is clarifying more deeply, practicing ever more deeply, and teaching more deeply the just sitting, this mind is Buddha, Zen and precepts are one suchness, and practice and realization are not two, non-dual. So we'll see what happens. I'll talk about them a little bit and see if anyone leaps out more than the others as a kind of focal point. So just sitting is maybe the simplest to talk about. Shikantaza, and people say, well, you know, that's the style of meditation in Soto Zen, the kind of classic style. So we often teach other styles of meditation and other practices of meditation, but the kind of classical constitutional style of meditation in the school. It's called Shikan Taza. Shikan means just or only. And ta is like a verbal emphatic, kind of like an exclamation point. So just sit. Just za means sitting, like zazen is sitting zen. So just sitting, or just wholeheartedly sit. And we sometimes could say, well, you know, this is very, very subtle practice, and some people say, like, it's almost impossible, almost nobody can actually practice just sitting. And they say, well, what is it, actually? Well, it's just sitting. And actually, anybody can practice it. right from the beginning, it's almost impossible not to practice it. If you sit down, you just sit, and that's it. And there's no further elaboration. In fact, it is the lack of any further elaboration on just sitting. But anyone who has sat down and with the intention to not further elaborate on such an activity knows that maybe it is quite challenging, right, to just sit. Not adding anything extra to a body sitting on a cushion in this world. And but another description, if we had to describe what just sitting is, we could say this very mind is Buddha. Is another version of the instruction of how to just sit. This very mind is Buddha. Meaning, again, no, without any further elaboration on this very mind of the present moment sitting, this mind is Buddha. Like a common elaboration would be the doubt that this very mind is Buddha. Well, that sounds all well and good, but I don't think so, because I'm just thinking about like wanting to like stop sitting and go like go home or run around the block or practice some like just walking or something like that, or else just the doubt that almost not elaborating, except I'm elaborating, that very thought is an elaboration, and like, okay, stop that. Okay, oh, that's another one. Oh. Like, so how could this be just sitting? But this very mind, that very mind, this very mind is Buddha. And in Dogen's essay called This Very Mind is Buddha, he quotes a long description of a view of an old Indian teacher in Buddha's time who taught that basically there's like a there's this fundamental unchanging essence of mind that isn't affected by anything and is indestructible and goes along through birth and death and is totally at peace all the time. And if we just merge with this indestructible essence of mind, that is liberation. And apparently the Buddha did not agree with this Indian teacher, and Dogen also criticizes this view. But when you're reading the description before he criticizes it, it sounds pretty good. It sounds like, wow, yeah, sounds good to me. It's very kind of inspired teaching about this unchanging essence of mind. And we hear teachings like this even in Zen, maybe even in Soto Zen. We hear things very similar anyway. And so it's an interesting thing that I won't get too into today, but you could read this essay of Dogen if you're interested. And then he talks a little bit about flowers and trees, rocks and pebbles are mind. This very mind is Buddha. So the flowers, trees, rocks, pebbles, mind is Buddha. Which sounds quite different than this, like, you know, fundamental essence of unchanging consciousness. But still, we might not find that, like, necessarily the most helpful Zazen meditation instruction to just say, okay, you want to know what just sitting is? Flowers, rocks, pebbles, mind being Buddha. Or maybe in Zazen, it's like, you know, platform, cushion, wall, ceiling, incense, smoke, mind is Buddha. And I've also been thinking about a story another thought too, just on that topic. I noticed for the first time there's so many beautiful things around the Zen Center here, you know, like the garden and the Zendo, and I haven't been here so much, but the more I walk through and looking at things, the more I appreciate the beauty of this place and all the creativity and care that goes into, that has gone into and continues to go into creating such a sanctuary. And I've admired in the past the stained glass window in the Dokusan room over here, and I was looking at it more closely today. It's the hand mudra like this with these circles in it. And I just thought it was artistic circles, and maybe you've talked about this already, but when I looked at it for the first time today, I saw it looked like the sun and moon, you know, within the hands. And I thought, probably intention, maybe not intentional, I don't know, but you know, what this mudra is called, the Hokkaido-in. Or in Sanskrit, it would be the Dharma Dhatu Samadhi Mudra. And Dharma Dhatu is like the whole universe, the Dharma realm, the cosmos. So sometimes, for sure, we call it the cosmic mudra. But it's the samadhi, the concentration of the universe. Or the samadhi is like a one-pointed absorption, and in great vehicle Buddhism, there's all these different names of samadhis. So one samadhi is the Dharma realm concentration, and the Dharma realm, Dharma Dhatu Samadhi. And this is the mudra of the entire universe concentration. Maybe Vairochana Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the universal, all-pervading Buddha that fills every molecule of the universe, that samadhi, that Vairochana invisibly is permeating, could say that's Vairochana's samadhi, and represented by this hand mudra. So it's like the mudra is enacting the concentration of the whole universe. And therefore, I thought in that stained glass window, you know, it's like containing the stars and sun and moon all within this circle of the universe here. And it's not only the sun and moon, it looks like in there that there's stars connected by the like lead, you know, of the stained glass window, like, and they're all connected. Probably because they have to be to make a stained glass window. But it was very beautiful. I sort of like had that vision when I saw it of, oh, this is the Dharma Dhatu Samadhi Mudra artistically depicted. And this is like, you know, sun, moon, stars, trees, pebbles, walls, platforms, cushions, incense, smoke, bells, people, eyes, nose, ears, samadhi, mudra. This mind is all of that. There's no other essential, fundamental, underlying essence other than all of that stuff completely arising and ceasing every moment. And we're absorbed in that arising and ceasing every moment of all things. And we kind of pull that whole vision and world into our hands like this, and tuck them up against our abdomen like this. It helps like the lower back come forward and the whole body straighten up, extending endlessly upward into the whole universe, touching the stars and planets and so on. But this is just sitting, you know. Just sitting as this very mind is Buddha. And then I was thinking about this story, because, you know, we hear these doctrines and tenets, and they sound, we like them. They sound nice, don't they? You know? And then there's this thing about this story in the old China, this teacher, Nan Chuan, and a kind of government minister, who was living in the world of, you know, writing constitutions and things like that, maybe. And he was also a Zen practitioner and student of Nan Chuan, and he came to Nan Chuan, and he also studied these Chinese teachings, and he quoted this kind of pre-Zen Chinese teacher, this treatise that was, some people say this teacher was a kind of precursor and inspiration for the Zen movement in China, but maybe, I think, before Bodhidharma. But he wrote these treatises that weren't quite Zen officially yet, but they sound kind of like Zen. And he quoted this little bit of this treatise of the teacher Song Zhao, and the treatise is something like, the part he quotes is like, I've heard in this treatise that that heaven, earth, and I have the same root, and all things and this body are one. Isn't that marvelous? He says to Nan Chuan. And isn't it marvelous? And he probably been like kind of really resonating with that teaching. And doesn't that say it all, like the Dharma Dhatu concentration mudra? Isn't it wonderful? But Nan Chuan says, his response was, he pointed to a flower in the garden and said, people today see this flower like in a dream. That's the story. So, wonderful, wonderful teachings and tenets and doctrines. Conceptual depictions of reality, so beautiful, and we have to, you know, get up here sometimes and talk about things like this. But not only words like this, but even the flower in the garden, people see this like in a dream. In other words, they don't really see the flower. I was really admiring these such bright, what are they, these flowers right out front?
Which ones?
The ones that are...
The 4 o'clocks?
The really bright, like pink, yeah. Fuchsia, 4 o'clocks?
Yeah. Huh.
4 o'clocks.
Very rare.
Yeah,
very rare. Extremely
rare.
I could tell. Oh, I could tell they were...
Get a haircut.
They take over the universe?
Yes.
You wish they were.
I could tell they were very rare, though. I mean, these ones were very rare, anyway. They were so bright. I don't know if I'd ever seen a flower that bright. And I kind of, like, I appreciated it so much, and still, and, but I was thinking about this story just before coming in, and I stopped to look at them, and I thought... People see these flowers like as in a dream. But this doesn't mean that we that there's some other way we're supposed to see them either. Therefore, in the dream of tonight's gathering, let me continue with these other two. Doctrines of the school. Please forgive me. Zen and precepts. Kai. Zen, kai, ichi, nyo. Zen or meditation. We could say zen meaning like zen, practice, the whole realm of zen, but maybe particularly Zen meaning meditation, which is what it means. Say meditation or concentration, meditative concentration, and kai, what we call precepts in the school, particularly bodhisattva precepts, or which are ways of living in the world. Well, different ways to look at the precepts, and maybe that's a whole other talk, but. I think interesting to put it as this way, you know, just on face value, the precepts as actually guidelines of ethical conduct, not killing, not stealing, and so on. We have such precepts, and from the time of Buddha, there's been virtue as one of the main trainings of practice, along with concentration. And thirdly, wisdom. These are the three. Buddha many times talked about the whole practice being encompassed by these three aspects. You can say virtue or precept, practice or ethical conduct, meditative concentration, and the understanding that the hands hold the sun and moon, wisdom. But in this case, the tenet of the school is that the Zen concentration practice and or just sitting, we could even say, just sitting. So to tie it back into the other two, just sitting and the precepts are one suchness, one complete peace. And this is how Dogen did talk about the precepts is... a little different than when Buddha talked about them as kind of like a precursor to concentration. Like first you practice virtue, you get your life in order, and be kind to others, and take care of all your relationships so that there's harmony there, and there's not... And in the most practical sense of it, it's just... as you might imagine, the very practical thing, if you're going to sit down and really settle into the present moment in a concentrated way, if you've just robbed a bank or something, it's going to be very hard to do that. You hear the sirens in the distance, okay, just calm down. You know, that's extreme, but like even small things, like, oh, you know, immediately often what happens when you sit is like, that conversation I had earlier today, like, I actually, I don't feel so good about it. And in fact, I didn't even notice that I didn't feel so good about it until I sat down and the mind got kind of quiet, and now all these things are arising, karmic activity that is having an effect right now. I think people who meditate know this experience, and I know people have talked about doing like longer retreats, or like going to a practice period at Tassajara or something, and they say for 3 months the whole practice period was nothing but just like mourning all the past mess that they were in from 20 years ago, even, you know, and that they haven't thought about it for 20 years. It all comes bubbling up, and that's like the content of the retreat, maybe. And maybe the next retreat, it's a little more settled. You know, stuff has to like percolate up and be released. So that's kind of the early one way of talking about maybe the Buddha's way of talking about precepts, virtue coming first as a necessary condition for concentration. Concentration being a necessary condition for this opening to this deeper understanding of the way things are. Dogen, in his usual non-dual way, doesn't talk about it this way so much. It's more that precepts and concentration and wisdom are one. So in fact, I'm just realizing now that these two doctrines, precepts and concentration, are one suchness, and then practice, you could say, is like the practice of zazen, concentration practice, and maybe precepts practice too, and realization, sometimes we say enlightenment, are not two. So there's all three of these trainings of early Buddhism in these two statements, which were pulled out of Dogen's teachings. Precepts and concentration are one suchness, or not two. And the practice of, we could say, precepts and concentration, and the realization or verification of awakening are not two. Therefore, these three trainings all work together at the same time. And Dogen would say, particularly in Zazen, he says, Dogen really emphasized the Zazen part. He says, well, someone's asked Dogen, well, shouldn't we be trying to memorize these precept sutras and reciting them many times every day? One of his students, I think, was doing that and said, like, shouldn't we do that? And Dogen said, that's too much. Just sit Zazen, but that's where you focus your attention on Zazen. And he says, in Zazen, what precept is not followed? What practice is not complete in really just sitting? And that sounds maybe kind of like easy, or that sounds like kind of like, yeah, that sounds good, but what about like my life, you know? I can't sit Zazen 24 hours a day, right? But I understand when Dogen says just sit Zazen and what precept is not being taken care of. I would understand that as like the mind of Zazen, which may not be when you're in sitting meditation, maybe in the midst of a very busy daily life activity. all the complications of our life and meeting people and so on. The mind of Zazen, the mind of just. I mean, the mind of just. Just doing what we're doing, and no elaboration. And if there's no elaboration on the elaboration. So just one piece or each activity, and in this way, isn't it true that actually? I mean, again, maybe this sounds too easy, and we can talk about this, how this plays out, but. But, you know, the urge to kill somebody or something is like, can't really arise in this non-elaborated mind. Again, it's, this is admitting that things get very tricky, right, in our life. This is easy to say, this kind of thing, and this is why this would be nice to talk about. But as a direction, to open to more and more deeply the mind of just present being, meeting each thing in that way, then can we trust that no harm will come? But we have to really, it has to be quite authentic being and non-elaboration, and we have, you know, great capacity to fool ourselves. So this is why it's helpful to delineate the precepts anyway, and then check them out in accord with Zazen or within Zazen. Or, you know, if we feel like, okay, I'm just in the present, I'm just like non-elaborating, and I'm like, now I'm going to kill this person. Like, then we still have the precept there, like not killing. I'm like, oh, so how does that make sense? Because we could say that these bodhisattva precepts are the activity of Buddha's mind. Buddha's mind and this very mind is Buddha, and Buddha's mind is taking care of each thing in a selfless way, because the self is kind of an elaboration. That's the fundamental elaboration that comes first. If we don't strongly elaborate that one, then we stay out of a lot of trouble. And practice and realization are not too. This is maybe, of all these, maybe most classic in a way of Dogen's trademark sayings. And I think there's some, it's easy to misunderstand, and there's maybe many interpretations too, but shusho funi, not to. Shusho, practice, and sho, we say, sometimes say practice dash enlightenment, but can't remember if I've talked about this here before. I think this is a great topic for conversations. This shusho of Dogen, he brings up this phrase many, many, many times in all different places. Practice enlightenment, or practice realization. But this sho means literally more like verification or confirmation. And you could say it implies it's verification or confirmation of enlightenment, and so then we shorten it to practice and enlightenment. But I think there's something really wonderful about looking at it as practice, and the verification are not two. And then we say, I think what the one that's maybe less clearly defined than enlightenment or verification, which is maybe not so clearly defined either, but practice. What is practice in this case? I think what often it gets interpreted as like sitting in a certain posture, and I think, you know, within the Soto school, I think many people have even seen it, like practice means like Soto Zen monastic practice, like you know, that you, all these forms and ceremonies that we do in a particular way, and sitting in this particular posture. And these are the things we call practice, because that's what Dogen called practice, because that was his life, that was his world of the Zen monastery. But that's not how I understand practice. I mean, I think if that's one's life, then that's the practice, right? But it's not necessarily like, if you're not doing that kind of activity, it's not practice. But then what is practice? Do we just say, well, everything is practice? That's maybe not so helpful either. But what if we say, and, you know, I haven't heard other people talk about it like this, but what if we're in this attempt to define practice, what if we say practice is the anything that's done with the intention or spirit of, we could say it in many ways, like letting go of self-concern. How about like that? Practice is anything done while releasing self-concern, at the moment of releasing self-concern. And it could be anything could be done this way. You could say, what about killing, releasing self-concern? I'd say, if you release self-concern, killing can't happen. So it will be wholesome, beneficial, harmless activity. And zazen, that's another description of just sitting. Zazen is just sitting, releasing self-concern. But it could be washing the dishes, or driving a car, or talking to somebody, whatever it is. And maybe this makes it too easy to talk about it this way, but that practice, and that's a practice, right? Releasing self-concern, that's a practice. And it's not separate from the verification of, well, enlightenment's kind of a big word, but like one moment of just peace and contentment and freedom. Is it not so that actually a moment of I want things to go like that, in that moment, it's actually, isn't that a moment that verifies peace? That's like the practice principle is at work here, right? This is like we're enacting it in one moment, and then we go back. Our karma is strong, our habits are strong. But I say, I have to go, I have to do it like this, and like, get out of my way. but then another moment, just stop. Stop, release, let go, maybe it's just a deep breath, even. Just a selfless breath. And verifies instantly for one moment, this very mind is Buddha. So lately, this is one way I've been thinking about practice and verification are not two. It's very kind of practical, simple way to look at it, not so mystical or anything, right? And it's a moment-to-moment thing. And it's like, well, why even bother saying it? Isn't it obvious? But, well, actually, it's quite profound in a way. Because you can say, well, what's so great about, like, a moment of letting go of self-concern? But actually, isn't that what it's all about? Isn't that one moment of like, yes. And it confirms the value of the practice, and it confirms what it's all about. And then we forget, but like, let's remember, let's like recognize and appreciate this confirmation and verification fully. Just like taste it, you know, like, yeah, like free for a moment. And then past karma kicks in, and like we're all messed up. but because it's a moment-to-moment thing, there's another way to put it. We can verify enlightenment any moment. It's an option. It's available. All it takes is a moment of practice, and the practice of just releasing self-concern. So again, all these things may be easier said than done, and people today see these flowers like in a dream. These are some tenets and doctrines of the Soto Shu that are the basis for setting up all these systems of like temples and supporters and boards and activities and everything else. But can it come from? So we have some time to discuss any of this, if you'd like. Any questions? Mm-hmm.
So should I feel bad that I'm plotting to cut the flowers to the ground?
These ones?
Mm-hmm.
Are you?
Your beautiful flowers. Yeah, we periodically do that. And now I'm sitting here going, oh my God, you use that as the example of, you know.
Well, then they grow back.
They sure do.
Very quickly. Later this summer. Because do you think they're taking over?
They are. And yeah, and then they cover up all the other flowers.
Well,
they're beautiful.
But to the ground, is that, I'm sure, necessary?
Well, this is, I mean, I'm being kind of silly, but I'm actually, I mean, it's a question.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real question.
I mean, I guess I would maybe leave some of them, but maybe that would be, you'd have to trim them more often then?
I don't know.
I mean,
leave some of them.
I do think that they're really beautiful, but I don't want to be attached to that beauty. So, I think it would be okay to cut them to the ground too. But, yeah, what would be the intention to cut them to the ground?
So that the other flowers can be seen.
I don't know how beautiful the other ones are. So, I trust you.
Actually, I like the idea of leaving some, so mm-hmm. that it can have its
mm-hmm.
place.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're really, like, spectacularly bright. I don't know if they have just, like, certain season, or if it's through the whole summer like that.
They're pretty stunning.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I appreciate them. Maybe certain areas could be cut back, or even to the ground, but leave other areas to go, like, take over the whole road. Yes. Hi.
Thank you for your words. I sit here listening, recalling how hard it is to believe in myself that enough that my muddled meditation is just right.
Mm-hmm.
It's always muddled, and I always keep saying it's muddled, and I have to have faith that this is exactly what it is, and that's it.
You have that faith. Then you just said you have trouble trusting that it's so?
That I have trouble trusting that it's just okay the way it is.
Because, interestingly, you know, in the Chinese character for faith is the same one that they translated as trust. Trust and faith are like synonyms, and maybe in English, in some way, they have a little different feeling, but they're similar. So I think sometimes we think of faith, and maybe this is in like the Christian sense, faith is maybe in something that we don't. It's kind of abstract, maybe, or like I have faith in that, but I don't really like know that it's so. It's not verified faith, whereas maybe trust is more like verification. Maybe in English, I don't know if it sounds like that to people. So sometimes when they translate this word as faith, I like to, in my mind, translate it as trust. Like the xin xin ming, faith in mind. This is, you know, could be translated as trust in mind, or the trusting mind, song of the trusting mind, which has a whole different feeling to me. Maybe for me, when I hear faith, I think of blind faith, which I don't think faith has to be that way, but kind of like, I have faith that that's so, but like, but it's maybe not. Or maybe I want to have faith, but I don't. Wait, so it sounds like you said, I have faith that that's, that my muddled mind is Buddha, but I don't trust. So it's like, in a way, maybe those aren't that different. If you could see how your faith, that it is so, is maybe not that different from trusting that it's so. And what is the difference based on... in terms of, you know, practice and verification, you could say right in the middle of this, the muddled meditation, like, oh, I can never concentrate. Maybe I've never actually concentrated ever before. And like, just sitting here and like, this can't be it. Like, but I've heard it, I have faith it is. Like, this must be it, but like, it can't be it. And in the middle of that whole thing, what's the practice? If the practice is like, oh, okay, there's some self-concern in that whole, like, dialogue, inner debate going on in dialogue. There's some self-concern in there. And what if the self-concern drops out of it? And then there's just maybe some little, like, chatter keeps going a little bit, like, oh, yeah, muddled mind, like, what's, oh, what? Oh, muddled flat, oh, hmm. And then, but maybe the self-concern drops at the bottom. And then it's like, maybe there's a verification that, oh, this muddled mind is Buddha. Could be. You could try it. You could see if something works with that. Mm.
Yeah. Kofia, could you say that the fact that she comes back again and sits down is verification of her trust? Or of her faith? So practice and verification are one.
Or is the coming back the practice?
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, the practice. And there's some verification. Yeah, maybe on a maybe more inconceivable level. That there's the it takes some letting go of self-concern to come back.
Especially right?
Yes, yeah. So if there's some part of the mind that's like, no, there's something here. And it's not just like, it's probably not just like, for the thousandth time, I've never done it, but maybe this time. It might be that, right? But it's probably, there's, at least on some deeper level, there's probably something else operating that's actually the practice of coming back, the selfless practice of coming back. And then there's some verification, maybe also inconceivable, of like, oh, yeah, there's some freedom and contentment is like circling around at the bottom of this practice, and that brings you back. Yeah, I think so. The first way I was talking about is like this very kind of on the surface level, like here's the practice and like here's the verification, and you can taste it. And then there's this deeper level where the practice you can't even maybe really see, and the verification you maybe can't even see, but here you are. Yeah, thank you for that point. Yeah.
When you're speaking of synchronicity, is that, confirmation. When you're speaking of confirmation, is that something like finding a synchronicity? Or getting something intuitively, what is the nature of the confirmation?
Well, the way that I was just talking about it, and maybe it's kind of a simplification, is the confirmation of like basic peace and contentment. So there's not very mystical or anything. It's just like relief from like my stuff for a moment, and like. That's like a confirmation, and it might not sound like the verification of unsurpassed enlightenment. That sounds so grand, right? But yet, other traditions talk about this too, like the word nirvana or nibbana, one of the greatest contemporary Theravada monks he talks about nirvana being this kind of like very everyday thing. Like we have, and it just means coolness. The etymology is like cool, you're just cool. There's a moment of peace and coolness. And he's like, people have this all the time throughout the day. People like kind of like touch nirvana. This is kind of not the usual sort of scriptural way of looking at it. But he's this is Ajahn Buddhadasa, you know, really, really great Thai masters. And that's his take on it. It's like, which is similar to this way, I think, that it's a quite simple thing, and it's a moment-to-moment thing, and it's just a moment of coolness throughout the day when like the self-concern is just not so activated. And I think usually the Buddha talks about it as like this irreversible coolness where self-concern can't arise again, which is a much more exalted sounding attainment, right? But practice is all like this. Do we have time for one quick one? One last question.
This just, I heard you say something about the breath earlier too, as part of this.
Breath.
I think of it as, you know, so for unaccountably at a certain moment, it would just breathe more easily. And that is, it's so physical and so, you know, it's so simple too. Our breath is always here.
Especially in exhale, it's like it's just a relief. Yeah, like there's some, we're holding something, and it's like a sigh, right? Mm-hmm. Like right at the end of the exhale, it's like nirvana for one moment, and then we're back into something. But this is a little, just one little practical thing in all this too about zazen is. I don't know if people do this, but I find so helpful right at the beginning of sitting down for zazen to take maybe like 3 really, really deep breaths, like nirvanic breaths, and like fully exhale. And after that, it's like, especially if you're really, really busy, kind of active mind right at the beginning of zazen, 3 breaths or sometimes even 1 really deep one, it's like, it's just like settled this much deeper notch. And if I don't do that sometimes, I'm still... It takes 40 minutes maybe to get into it. Yeah, breath. Thanks for coming tonight and to this communion of Sotoju holiness. May our intention extend everywhere endlessly for the benefit of all beings. Beings are...
Delusions are inexhaustible.